Welcome to That's a Wrap, episode number 2. I'm Eric Marshall. With me is Chris Gullen.
Hello, everybody.
And Nick Schlegel.
Hello.
Today we are talking about streaming wars, what Amazon and Netflix are doing to take over the world. We're also going to have a discussion of House of Cards, and we have a very special guest today with Chuck Tryon of Fayetteville State University. When we talk to Chuck, we're going to try to avoid any spoilers for House of Cards. So if you haven't seen the series, you're pretty safe there. After our discussion with Chuck, we are going to do a special spoiler edition. So if you haven't seen it, you might not want to listen to that. If you have, then you will. So, but first, let's have a little chat. What's up with you guys?
Well, not much. I think it's always appropriate to begin the show with what we lovingly call our pickups. And there's a few pickup shots we need this week in relation to our last podcast, which was really well received by listeners. By and large, everybody had given us feedback saying that they enjoyed the show, that it was light and basically a pleasure to listen to. What about you guys?
Yeah, very, very happy with the reception. I want to thank all of my friends, our friends, who downloaded it, listened to it, gone to iTunes. Please do that and rate it. Liked us on Facebook. So just end of the semester stuff and good things now that spring is here.
Yep, I'm really excited too. We had some audio problems last time, but I think we've got most of those worked out. We have our very first guest today, Chuck Tryon. He'll be on a little bit later, which is really exciting. I'm really impressed too with the amount of feedback we've had on Facebook and on the blog. That's a wrapshow.com. And if you want to give feedback, you can like us on Facebook. You can go to the blog. That's a wrapshow.com. And you can look us on iTunes as well. We're hoping that as people subscribe through iTunes that people will also take a minute or two to give us 4 or 5 stars, 3 stars, 2 stars, whatever you want. It doesn't matter.
However many stars they feel are appropriate.
So as long as it doesn't say no reviews anymore, we would really appreciate that. But yeah, so far so good, and we're looking forward to this discussion. Nick, you had some specific shout-outs, I think.
Yeah, well, I concur. I'd like to thank everybody for going to the Facebook page and liking us, and encourage any new listeners to do so. It's one way that you can keep informed with the news feed with the frequent posts that are made on there. I do have a very special shout out to give to John Adams, who designed the logo for That's a Wrap podcast, and John's a very talented, very gifted, very expeditious graphic designer out there who's has a website which we'll post at the thatsawrapshow.com website, and by all means you should stop by there and check out his work, and consider this certainly a referral to him. He did a wonderful job for us. We're all very happy with it.
All right, great. I think with that we can go right to principal photography in our interview with Chuck Tryon. So we have Chuck Tryon of Fayetteville State University. He's assistant professor there. And welcome.
Thank you.
We were going to talk about Amazon Prime, Netflix streaming, the Netflix properties that they have coming out on streaming, and just digital distribution in general, because Chuck is, of course, a kind of an expert on this, coming out with a second book. What's the title of your second book?
On Demand Culture, Digital Distribution and the Future of Movies.
Yep, and we'll put a link to the. I know on Amazon you've got like a coming June something.
Yeah, I keep hearing slightly different dates on that. I think the author's copies will be in my hands sometime in May. I don't quite know when it'll be live on Amazon where it'll be for sale, but I'm guessing it'll be a little bit before June, but we'll see.
And all three of us are also somewhat familiar with your first book, Reinventing Cinema, Movies in the Age of Media Convergence, which seems to be in some ways a bit of a precursor.
Yeah, I sometimes call this Reinventing Cinema 2.0, which is, you know, maybe suggests that I didn't move far enough along to something different. But I think, I think it was Philip Drake, I want to say, who made an argument in an essay collection that distribution is going to be the kind of driving question for the next decade. And I'd heard others, he's a professor, I believe, at Columbia, and he's also a film producer, Ira Deutschman, who has said something similar about distribution being kind of the driving question for the next at least decade or so as all of this shakes out with, video stores basically disappearing at this point and everything going digital. So what happens next is a big question.
And what does happen next? I mean, we're kind of living in the midst right now of some of this streaming revolution that's going on.
Maybe Netflix will buy Comcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually start internet and cable distribution.
Yeah, there's some buzz. There's been speculation for years about who will buy Netflix at some point in the future. And, they keep riding along and kind of bouncing along. I didn't get a chance to look at it in detail, but I know Hastings recently released about 11 page report, his vision for the future of the company. And,
reading that. Yes.
And some of that, I'll let others add because I've only read pieces of it, but, he's continuing to kind of pitch Netflix as competition for cable channels like HBO. And I think that's a pretty astute way of thinking about it because, so few people watch the majority of their programming as it airs on television, and Netflix becomes a box just like HBO where you can get some content, some of it original, and some of it content they've licensed, much like HBO. And so I think that they're continuing to evolve and experiment with these kind of different modes of distribution, and so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, Chuck, I've got a little portion of that right in front of me right now. I can quote from it a couple of lines here. He says in that sort of new mission statement, if you will, that over the coming decades and across the world, internet TV will replace linear TV. Apps will replace channels, remote controls will disappear, and screens will proliferate. As internet TV grows from millions to billions, Netflix, HBO, and ESPN are leading the way. And it goes on to give us some statistics about in the first quarter of 2013 worldwide, Netflix has now 36.3 million streaming customers, 29 million of which are in the United States alone. So, and in terms of trends, do you see this really sort of getting tremendous traction right now among the media consumers?
That's my feeling. I think two or three years ago when I would poll my students, very few of them had Netflix accounts. And now I think most of them have either Netflix or Hulu, plus, or, at least one of those two and maybe some combination of two or three subscription services. So I think that, you can look at, some of the more traditional ways of consuming media. The last two non-adult video stores in Fayetteville, North Carolina, the last two Blockbusters closed. And so, you can go to a Redbox, but you can't go to like a bricks and mortar video store and expect to rent, Pocahontas or something, so it's definitely changing. And I think, it's even the move away from DVD to streaming has actually even been faster than Hastings, I think, originally expected a couple of years ago. And some of that may be driven by price points. I mean, the subscription service eventually for the DVD just became somewhat prohibitively expensive unless you were really renting a lot of DVDs. So
yeah, that's for sure. I know that when remember they split off into Flixster, is that what it was called?
Yeah,
that was no,
Flixster. It was called Quixster.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, because Flixster is actually
that's a different thing. Yep.
Owned by Warner Brothers.
Yeah, that's right. When they did that, that was Reed Hastings' way to – he was trying to kill DVDs at that point. He wanted to make DVDs go away and just focus on the streaming, and that was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Kind of a fiasco, but so I think that's his goal, is to get rid of the DVD side of the business.
And it makes sense because, I mean, it's kind of their version of bricks and mortar, because they do have to have, you know, all the equipment, the sorting stations, the employees. You know, they're the biggest customer right now, the Postal Service, which, you know, I'm sure the Postal Service would like these things to stay around, but, but they, you know, it's much more labor intensive than the streaming video side of things. And, you know, it demands much more space in terms of, warehouses in different parts of the country. So I think, there's not much incentive for Netflix to maintain that for a long time, I don't believe.
Well, that's a really good point that Eric brought up about the whole DVD, you know, killing the DVD side of the business. And I think the other thing with, you could weigh in on this with the, Chuck, with the idea of mergers, because it seems that a lot of, a lot of my students have the same thing where they have, Netflix or Hulu or a combination. But it also seems that depending on which programming, each one of these services is offering, that can determine how long people stay in the service. So, you know, you have people who might go onto Hulu for the second and third seasons of Downton Abbey, and then they cancel it and go back to Netflix. Mm. So the whole idea of mergers, who's going to buy what? Oh, yeah. Because Amazon just bought the rights to stream all of Downton Abbey. So now people have to, you know, you have this overlap. Sure. So you have people who are going to go from, if they want to watch Downton Abbey first three seasons, they have to, go with Netflix or Hulu. They have to then go to Amazon Prime, which is then yet another service.
Right. I think in my case, I may have written a blog post about this, but, or something. My wife and I belatedly discovered, Downton Abbey late in season three. And I think we watched season one on Netflix, season two on Hulu Plus, which I happen to have a membership of for a research project I was doing.
Of course.
And then I believe we watched season three, and we were only about 2 days late on this, but we watched season three on Amazon Prime. And if we had been about a day earlier, we could have watched the final episode live, which really disappointed me, because wow. I wanted to actually catch it on four different, streaming or whatever services and kind of hit all the bases. But, I mean, one of the arguments in my book is, an attempt to critique some aspects of Chris Anderson's argument of the long tail. And, you know, he has this idea of the celestial multiplex where all the movies will be in the sky and all you have to do is reach up and grab them and watch them or whatever. And
the cloud.
Yeah, the cloud, but it's one happy little cloud. And my feeling is that it's not a single celestial multiplex, but a bunch of competing,
yes,
incomplete, partial multiplexes. Some of them are the equivalent to dollar theaters and have like Crackle, like a bunch of old movies that would normally air on like TNT on 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday or something, or old Seinfeld reruns, that may not have a lot of value, but, Crackle can give them for free with cheap advertising. And then you have more premium types of services, whether the Criterion Collection on Hulu Plus, which I guess would be the art house theater. You know, it's never that clearly delineated, though, because something that's very artsy or whatever might also be on Netflix or might be on Netflix instead. And so it's, I think, going to create a lot of problems for people who are maybe looking for specific texts where, you know, browsing the shelves at Blockbuster or Hollywood Video, you can see what's there. And here it seems like it's harder to navigate that.
It seems very much like, just like you said, we've entered into a streaming wars, you know, scenario where we used to have like the cable network news wars and things like that. But definitely, we're into a streaming wars thing. And, with Netflix seeming to sort of, you know, have a foothold in it all. And I want to ask you a direct question. I imagine you talk about it or you can tell us what you talk about in your new book. And that is, I found that Netflix to be really useful in the classroom. When I need to watch a film or something like that, and our own library doesn't have it, or it's, you know, a film that I don't own, I can just bring it right up and screen it or portions of it. It's really useful. But, you know, it turns into a double-edged sword because, and I have a thought that begins really with your first book, which is in the way in which the consumer dismantles and analyzes film and the birth of the film geek via Laserdisc, VHS, DVD, and so on. And I wonder if we're not seeing some of that mentality sort of like breed bad habits among the younger generation, where perhaps these bad habits are spilling over into the movie theater, talking, texting, phones. They feel that they're comfortable. They're in their own house. And the other thing is that sometimes I wonder about attention deficits with films, whether or not we sort of just get bored and tune out because we're constantly watching films on our television, in our bedroom, in the basement, in the rec room. And I'm wondering what it's doing to culture, if you touch upon that, if I've made myself clear.
Yeah, I mean, I have two or three answers to that. One is that Regal Cinemas flew the idea, I don't know if it ever came into fruition, but flew the idea of dropping its ban on texting in movie theaters. And they were going to, at least during certain screenings, permit people to text or tweet or whatever they want to do. And I don't know how they would say, you know, this is a texting movie and this one isn't. So basically, it would completely drop the ban. So, you know, I think we've become incredibly accustomed to these so-called second screen viewing experiences. And yeah, I mean, you know, there's a lot of discussion about how positive discussion that says, well, this allows for a more engaged film or TV audience. And, you know, we can all go and mock the Oscars in real time and make fun of James Franco or whoever's hosting. And that's all great. But, you know, when you're asking someone to immerse themselves in an Antonioni film or something like that, that requires more attention and a different kind of experience that may be waning.
You know, Chuck, when you said the whole thing about the Regal Cinema dropping the ban, I instantly got this picture in my head of a cinema full of young people watching a film on one screen and then having an iPad mini, an iPhone, all watching separate films on Netflix and different services. And that's just instantly what came to my mind. And
Distracted spectator seems to be an issue these days.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that sense of distraction or partial attention is kind of reemerging. And, you know, there are other theater chains that have made very explicit. The Alamo video is priceless. I mean, it's brilliant. But the other kind of question that I have, it's a similar one. And, you know, to me, one of the things that comes across with the DVD in a very material way is that idea of the film geek. And I should have been more explicit, I think, in aligning that with the materiality of the DVD as a storage system. Because now I think with streaming, if I'm not mistaken, Hulu has a few of the Criterion extras available, you know, with their streaming subscription to Hulu Plus. But as far as I can remember, Netflix doesn't have that option yet. And so those modes of engagement are more diffused now. And the sense of identity that one might have from collecting all the DVDs by a favorite director, or listening intently to Scorsese or Coppola or David Fincher or someone talking about their intentions with a film. I wonder if that's become less commonplace. I mean, I know that, some directors have recorded podcasts inviting people to go back and rewatch the movie in the theater, and you just download the podcast and listen to it while you're watching the movie. The director of Looper, Ryan Johnson did that. And it was a decent director's commentary track, but I think that may also be changing in a way, and that kind of concept of the film geek that was directly associated with the DVD might actually be waning, at least in some form.
Well, Netflix is actually later this year, or soon, I think, going to be releasing House of Cards on DVD.
Oh, I did not know.
Yeah, oh, interesting.
Yeah, they are. They're going to be releasing it on DVD, which really Double is going to be interesting, yeah, to see what happens if the people who've seen the series, streamed it, watched it, and if there's going to be any interest, it's going to be,
right.
I think the onus is going to be on them to really pack the DVDs with tons of extras to really get those film
or geeks. Temporarily take it down from streaming.
Exactly.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see if they do that, which means I need to watch it quick because I'm only about 5 episodes in.
Okay. Well, we'll try not to give you any spoilers when we do. If
it's all right.
So.
We're definitely going to discuss it, but we'll probably, you know, do some additional discussion after you've
hung up.
Because there's some spoilers I think we're going to get into.
Okay.
But we can jump into that. What do you think about House of Cards?
I'm really enjoying it. It's just one of those things that with the end of the semester and some other obligations, I did reviews of at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival for Filmmaker Magazine. So, I've just not been able to sit down and watch the last 3 or 4 episodes, or 5 episodes. And, I think, in some ways it feels like it's saying what we already know about Washington, about the corruption and, the horse trading and all of those kinds of things. I do think that Kevin Spacey's, character is beautifully drawn, that kind of Southern, moderate Democrat type figure is really, really fascinating in a lot of ways. So I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying the interplay between, Washington and old and new media and how the blogger character, I think it's Kate Mara who's playing her.
Yeah.
And how that plays into things. And so I think it's a really smart series and it's doing quite a bit that's fun to talk about and fun to think about. I just need to whip through those last 6 episodes at some point.
Yeah, I think so too. I like Kevin Spacey's character too, although his accent drives me crazy. It drove me crazy for a while until I got used to it because it kind of comes and goes, you know?
Yeah, he doesn't hang on to it completely. Yeah. And I kind of wonder how someone, I believe he's actually from Spartanburg, where I've been several times, where his character is. And I wonder if that's authentic to that part of the state or not. I don't really.
No idea. But, so that, that's kind of annoying sometimes, but he, I think he does a good job and I think he's well cast in that role. And I think I agree with you on everything you said. There were some cringe moments where, like, the when she gets that job as a blogger, like, the decor of that place
slug
is
line.
So...
Yeah,
slug
yeah. line. I have comments about that, actually.
Yeah. Stuff like that. But, yeah, overall, I agree with you. I do like what they do with the text messaging, having it on the screen, you know, kind of
yeah.
the new media thing. But what I think Netflix is doing is, like, we know they're kind of going after HBO a little bit, right?
Sure.
And so they're not competing with network television, obviously, with, you know, just with the content of this show and the sex, explicit sex, the swearing. And I think that's a good direction for them. You know, they're kind of, it's their first series and they're basically saying, look, we're going after HBO with content as well as distribution.
Right. And it, you know, it does fit in that quality TV tradition that you could kind of rope something like Mad Men and some other shows in with it, but definitely, you know, pushing the envelope in the same way that HBO does in terms of showing things that you can't even on basic cable show explicitly. So I think they're very conscious of that.
It's funny, Eric should mention the slug line thing. I have a lot of thoughts about that because for me, one of the things about the show that I find really interesting is that it captures the chaos of our contemporary freelance journalism scene very nicely. It seems like the Kate Mara character is very sort of constricted in a straitjacket in the formal editing processes at whatever newspaper she's at. I forget which one it is, but and then of course when she's, you know, skipping all these rungs on the ladder and then they offer her like the bureau spot for, you know, the, you know, White House correspondent and she turns it down to go work at this sort of crazy, you know, commune basically, like Eric was saying. It's sort of, it looks like a lounge in a school cafeteria or something. But by the end, and I'm not giving anything away here, guys, but by the end of the season, it's interesting how she and another character wind up kind of embracing the structure of traditional journalism to get back on track. And I just want, not that it's a big spoiler or anything.
No, but yeah, I mean, you know, I can tell it's engaging with some of those questions so I'll be curious to see where it evolves. You know, the other side to it, I think, is the interplay with, the NGOs and the nonprofits you know, I think that's fascinating as well. And of course the kind of complicit relationship between Spacey and his wife, and kind of their, at least at the beginning, they're kind of, behind the scenes assistance for each other. And, so, you know, that kind of incestuousness is classic Washington.
Yeah. The whole thing makes you feel dirty.
Oh yeah.
it's very cynical, and it's funny because I've been watching this and I'm right in the series where you are, Chuck, about 5-6 episodes in. And at the same time, and I didn't plan this, but at the same time I'm finishing up reading John Ronson's The Psychopath Test.
Okay.
A Journey Through the Madness Industry. You are familiar?
I'm not, no.
Well, it's a fascinating book about psychopathy. And one of the themes in Ronson's book, one of the goals he has is trying to see if people at the top of society in politics and capitalism are actually psychopaths. And he uses the 20-point hair test. And I was reading this and I'm watching this series and I find myself looking at every single one of these characters and doing the 20-point check of whether these people are psychopaths. And with the exception of two, Russo and Christina, everyone in the show displays blatant psychopathy. I mean, they're
wow.
It, if you look at and just Google of the Bob Hare test, which is a 20-point test, and it's been used for a long time for psychiatrists to gauge whether somebody displays psychopathic tendencies, and you start applying that to the characters in this show. Yeah, they're psychopaths. I mean, they are. It's really interesting, actually.
That's not the book that the documentary The Corporation is based on, because they do something very similar where they take
the
DSM and look at the diagnosis of being a psychopath and capitalism qualifies under pretty much every ground.
Yes. Yeah, it's a fascinating book.
So,
do you think with something like House of Cards that, I mean, clearly it's, the critics pretty much have given it unanimously positive reviews, generally speaking. And, one has to wonder that what the Emmys will take notice probably, you know, in the next Emmy cycle. Does it seem to you, and particularly in relationship to what you've written in the book, then that this is, the streaming model will be a really strongly embraced model based upon perhaps the success of House of Cards and Arrested Development, which is coming up in a couple of weeks.
Right. Yeah. I'll be curious because, you know, both of House of Cards and Arrested Development are playing off of, even though they're new, they're created by Netflix. You know, there was a British House of Cards, obviously, that apparently was very popular with Netflix users, and that was one of the reasons they chose to adapt it. And with Arrested Development, obviously, you know, that show has its own cult status from being on television for, what, 3 or 4 seasons?
2.5.
2.5. And so they, you know, they have these things that are kind of already pre-branded for them that are relatively easy to market. My understanding is that the horror series that was done by Eli Roth didn't do nearly as well.
Hemlock Glen or Hemlock Grove?
Yeah.
Hemlock something.
Yeah.
And obviously none of us have watched it, right?
So,
not a big deal, I'm going to watch
it. You know,
yeah.
I think, yeah. You know, one of the questions with Netflix is, I mean, obviously the goal is to try to attract subscribers or get more. I don't know if you can hear the phone in the background. So one of the goals is to keep subscribers, to retain subscribers, and then knowing that probably a few of them will buy in for a couple of months, drop out, and then come back when a new series interests them. So you know, it's a different model than, say, Amazon that's basically just transactional, and you come in and unless you have the Amazon Prime account, you come in, you pay for one $4.99 episode or series or movie, and so there might be different goals for whatever service, Amazon, Netflix, Hulu Plus, etc. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a good point. It makes me wonder what Amazon's going to do, because Amazon's obviously trying to compete with Netflix with original programming with these program, but I don't know. I think the pilots are free to watch. I think anybody could watch them, Prime or not.
Yeah.
When and if they develop them into series, what are they going to do? Are they going to be for Prime members? Will they be a la carte? We don't know.
Probably both a la carte and for Prime members. Seems to be their trend. You know, one of my interests is how these services have made a very deliberate effort to target both adult and youth or even child audiences. And one thing we didn't talk about with the Amazon pilots is that there were 8 kind of quote unquote adult comedies, but there were also 6 shows aimed at children. And, you know, Amazon Kids and, you know, Netflix obviously has the kids interface. And even overseas, I've talked to, friends in Germany and Brazil and a couple of other countries. And even those seem to be making a very deliberate effort to have a kids section that A is safe, quote unquote, from, you know, potentially having things that kids aren't supposed to see, but B, you know, things that interfaces that are kid friendly so that, you know, basically 5-year-old children are being trained on how to get on these services. And, you know, that training is now quote unquote starting really young.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I don't know if the kids programs have gotten any press or if anyone's talking about them. I watched all the adult programs on Amazon Prime, and I think every single one of them has at least one F-bomb, if I'm not mistaken. So they really are going for an adult you know, kind of thing. Probably trying to distance themselves also from network TV.
Sure.
But yeah,
sure.
As far as the kids stuff goes, I didn't watch any of those, but that's a really good point because, yeah, when you pull up Netflix on your, like on our PS3, you have two interfaces. You have the kids interface, which has bigger typeface or whatever they call it, bigger fonts, bigger pictures. It's all picture driven, and of course, there's no adult stuff, right?
Right.
So that is interesting.
Right, right.
They're starting to train, like you say, train kids at an earlier age to not turn on the TV, but to go to these various streaming sites in order to get their content.
Right. And it's also the other point that I'll make about that is, you know, there's a long history, of course, of home media, whether television like the Disney Channel or the Wonderful World of Disney cartoons, VCRs, DVDs. One of the earliest adapting groups has actually been parents with young children, because they're always seeking out electronic babysitters for their kids.
And they tell two friends, and they tell two friends, and so on. Yeah.
Right. And so it's, you know, it's a fantastic deal for parents, because they can do chores, cook dinner, and plop their kids in front of Netflix now, as opposed to a DVD player, and feel like their children are getting safe content that they won't have to worry about.
You know, I wanted to backtrack just to make two points. The first one was something that you said, which was, yeah, I hadn't really thought about it when you said that Netflix, others had already done the heavy lifting. You're absolutely right. House of Cards was, you know, an English import that they just sort of like readapted to fit the Washington, you know, milieu, the psyche. And same thing with Arrested Development, which comes complete, you know, part and parcel with its own cult audience built in, and it's one of the most hyped and anticipated events, you know, 7 years after its cancellation. It's wonderful stuff. I hadn't thought about that. It's a bit different from sitting down and writing Breaking Bad or something, you know, just coming up with something original.
Right. You know, I mean, I think House of Cards in particular had branding from several different perspectives. One was the British series, but certainly Kevin Spacey as a star persona that might fit a certain audience that, you know, maybe kind of an art house audience because of his history with Usual Suspects and Seven and a number of other shows. But also David Fincher as a kind of auteur, as someone lending credibility to the series. And I think they tried that with the Eli Roth horror series, but I don't know if it just, if his star persona wasn't as strong or whatever. You know, Fincher obviously had a lot of credibility because of The Social Network that was, seems to be a more distinct part of Netflix's niche is that kind of discerning audience.
You know, and the entire House of Cards seemed, there's some meta commentary that I've observed from it is that Frank and Kate Mara character, what's her name? Frank and what's her name?
Claire.
No, that's his wife. Zoe. Frank and Zoe have this sort of really bizarre thing where they keep saying feed me. They text feed me to each other. They say, I fed you, now you got to feed me. And it conjured up these images of like birds regurgitating matter into each other's mouth. So like for like nutritional purposes and because they're bringing them. And I thought, you know, this seems to be like a, if I was going to be so bold, a meta commentary on media consumption in general, the sort of like sick cycle of news, the way it goes back and forth between them. Kind of, whether there's moral ambiguity there or not, I can't say, but it did strike me as this bizarre sort of round robin of...
no pun intended?
Yeah, no pun intended. Just kind of nastiness, really.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly on the level of political commentary, you know, that hyper-accelerated news cycle and the constant need to be, quote-unquote, fed... and then to process that and feed the audience is, you know, just so utterly palpable in terms of sites like Gawker and, I mean, even more partisan political blogs like Daily Kos. I mean, the churn of posts is so rapid and you know, to get more and more and more page views, which is the currency in the internet age. You know, there's just incredible churn, and which is a slightly different metaphor, but you know, they have to constantly feed each other to kind of keep the feedback loop going, I guess.
Well, that's a good, Nick, that's a really good point with the fact that looking at House of Cards now, you know, it's a political drama, and you know, contrasting that with, you know, the last big political drama, The West Wing, you know, the changes, the stark changes and approaches to politics as times have changed and embraced social media, we've become more cynical about government with things like the Occupy and capitalism with the Occupy movement and et cetera. It's just, to look at those two shows, even though they're both kind of within the same genre, you know, you have one that's a political drama and one, you know, the West Wing, and then one where House of Cards is almost a political neo-noir.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, I think there's always been at least some cynicism. I mean, if you go back to something like All the President's Men back in the 70s, I mean, there's definitely plenty of cynicism there. And even the other Robert Redford thing, The Candidate. So there's a fair history of that. But I think Sorkin, with both American President and West Wing, spoke to and Obama actually mentioned this in the White House correspondence speech, you know, this kind of Aaron Sorkin liberal fantasy about how politics works, and this kind of wish that it would kind of function like we would imagine in our classically liberal, not politically liberal fantasies about, you know, government solving our problems and people coming together in Washington and holding hands, and that just isn't happening right now. And so I think House of Cards speaks to that moment in a pretty effective way.
I couldn't agree more. But I'd love to talk to you when the show's finished, because one of my primary, if I had an axe to grind with it, it would probably be very much along that line. You know, how to phrase this? Let's see. I guess one of the problems I have with the show is it, rather than focus on character, it tends to focus a lot on plot contrivance. It is a big house of cards that Caesar couldn't pull off. And, you know, it's sort of like it's revenge motivated. It's ugly. There's not any likable characters. The only likable characters are Peter and Christina. And, you know, rather than sort of like, I don't know, engage in the way that we get invested on the level of character, we're trying to root for anti-heroes, and they're all pretty scummy anti-heroes on top of that. It's sort of like, it's just hard to find someone to root for in that show. Yeah. And it's usually,
right.
It's not the house on the hill, the city on the hill portrait that you were saying, the fantasy, but it could aspire in some minor ways to go there, but it chooses not to. And I don't know if there's, you know, what's at the heart of that.
And some of it, maybe just thinking out loud, is the degree to which we've all become more attentive to the kind of political mechanisms. I mean, you can't, even on like NBC or CBS or national or even local news, some discussions of things like filibusters and you know, the completely depressing vote on handgun issues, where a majority theoretically voted for increasing background checks incrementally, and yet it was voted down because it didn't pass the filibuster threshold. So I think between that and like liberal and conservative blogs that talk about the process, people have become more astute, and so that kind of the machine itself becomes this object of fascination that people want to understand. But that being said, that machine can only function as this perfect machine almost is if the only way that can happen is if every single character in it is cynical. Theoretically, I think, because if one character was trying to fix it. I don't, you know, I don't know how that would work. I mean, I almost think they have to be cynical.
That's interesting. Yeah, because
think about Peter.
Yeah, because of the the people who are not cynical don't succeed. Let's put it that way. Without giving spoilers, but without, and you can see it already in the first five episodes that
Are
people who are naive and they just get pushed around, including maybe even the vice president in this thing.
Right.
So that's a very good point, and I guess. Yeah, Netflix is probably counting on us having some familiarity with the way government works, but also some cynicism ourselves, perhaps, which is not hard to kind of muster
these
several years, right? Everybody seems a little cynical, so they're playing on that. But I think, you know, Netflix and Amazon both are very data-driven companies. And Netflix is, you know, is playing the numbers in a way, too, playing on our cynicism, playing on the popularity of some kind of political movies, political TV shows, maybe The West Wing as well, getting Kevin Spacey, who everybody likes, right? Getting David Fincher, who everybody kind of knows, like he said, from The Social Network, or The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, Fight Club, everybody, you know, everybody knows Fincher. Well,
right.
So they're kind of playing the numbers in a way. And going back to the, I guess, the trope of regurgitation, you know, they're resting on the reputation of House of Cards and Arrested Development. And I think Amazon's doing the same thing, again, with a data-driven sort of model, where you mentioned at the very beginning when I first hit record, we were talking about The Onion.
The Onion pilot was one of the ones that was persistently or consistently, rather, in the top three or four for most people. And, you know, I think that one aspect for many of the people who were reviewing the pilots was the fact that The Onion offers a very familiar niche in that everyone kind of knows The Onion at this point because the publication's been around for about 20 years. And so it was something easily recognizable. It fits into category that people could grasp. And so I think that was maybe part of what drives how these things work, the kind of popularity and consensus driven voting that, you know, it's somewhat, although you don't have to invest money, it's somewhat similar, or at least right away, to Kickstarter in that it's a popularity contest in some ways.
And with the Amazon, everyone kind of knows The Onion, right? And I think they're doing the same thing with Zombieland. Where everybody knows Zombieland, so they do a pilot of Zombieland, right?
Oh, that's a good example. And although a lot of people were saying, well, it's Zombieland without the stars, so if you really, you know.
Yeah, which but, unfortunately it's the stars that kind of carried that movie.
Exactly.
So, oops. Right. But they're also, like all the other pilots are very formulaic. One's a musical, you know, one is kind of, you know, looks like something you would see on Adult Swim. You know, they all take, if not names and reputations, they're doing genres or kind of, tropes of like that we already know and trying to kind of clone them and see what happens. So there's this kind of trying to do what people already know in a way, but doing it on a new format.
Right. I think one of them had kind of a Big Bang Theory type of vibe. And so, you know, I think, Netflix, there's an amazing amount of data that's generated, even things like when you stop an episode, when you pause, fast forward, when you rewind, they literally generate billions of data points on a daily basis. And, you know, I can imagine some future in which they give David Fincher notes. I mean, you know, essentially we're the world's largest perpetual test screening for Netflix. And, you know, theoretically they could say, you know, it bogs down when these characters are on screen. Are we going to write them out?
Right. That is interesting.
And I, you know, who knows, but I think that, I mean, they have so much information about how we watch. And it was, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's a good point. It was very calculated to bring all of these factors together in that, you know, when it launched, I mean, there were so many people ranging from like Slate, Daily Kos, you know, all these different kinds of publications, some political, some cultural, some you know, obviously like the new TVs and the TechCrunches, they had like four or five clusters of reviewers that were just chomping at the bit to be the first people to post their review of House of Cards. And I think Netflix knew that was going to happen, and they were able to capitalize on that to generate tremendous buzz for the series. So,
yeah, so they're relying on new media as well for marketing and reviews as well, you know, rather than traditional media, which makes a lot of sense for a company like that. So it's very interesting what they've got going on. I know you're pressed for time, right? So we should probably begin to wrap.
Yeah, I should probably wrap the next.
But I thought this was a really great discussion.
Oh yeah, very much so. I can't wait for the book to drop.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear what people have to say about it. I hope it contributes to the conversation a little.
Well, how could it not? Your timing is fantastic with it. Yeah. Or the publisher's time, or everybody's timing came with a confluence of good timing here.
Yeah, it kind of got it done quickly, so I was able to hopefully get it out there at a good moment.
We're all excited about it.
So thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. So once again, this is Chuck Tryon of Fayetteville State University.
Thanks everyone for doing this. I really enjoyed the conversation.
We're linking to your blog in our show notes at our website. That's arapshow.com, and we'll have other relevant links and things in there that we've discussed.
And what's your dog's name? Because we could hear your dog a little bit in the background.
Isabel, or Izzy for short.
Oh, she's that's great. That's great.
She's our brave and intrepid Chihuahua.
Nice.
She protects us from anyone who comes within 50 feet of the house. It's very touching.
I'm glad she was able to contribute as well to the conversation.
Yeah, she's not a Kevin Spacey fan, but
that's too bad.
That might have been why she was complaining.
I see.
But we'll tell Netflix. So.
So.
All right. Well, thanks for doing this, Chuck. We appreciate it.
All right. Good to talk to you guys.
Yep. Welcome to the spoiler edition of House of Cards. We purposely didn't give any spoilers during the interview because Chuck hadn't seen all of the show. So we thought we'd do a little discussion for those of you who have watched the entire thing or who don't care about spoilers. So Nick has something to say.
Well, yeah, I really wanted to bring this up when we were talking with Chuck. But obviously, you know, it was prohibitive because he didn't want to hear any spoilers. So I think the thing I wanted to say the most was it's odd when you come across a scene that, or segment or sequence that to you encapsulates the essence of an entire show. The totality of a show is sort of like filtered down into one special sequence or scene. And for me, in House of Cards, that scene was when, Claire, Frank's wife, goes to visit the security guard, or the chief executive security officer who basically had taken care of Frank for many, many years, most of his political life. And he's dying of cancer in a hospital, and Claire goes to visit him. And this scene's really intense, basically. She goes in there, and he basically begins to tell her that although he's spent the better part of his life protecting this man, that he absolutely can't stand this man. He hates this guy. He thinks that he's a truly reprehensible and evil human being. And essentially, he also confesses that, you know, he's had a bit of a crush on her or has admired her from afar. Claire's response to this is kind of shocking, to say the least. She basically, you know, takes a knee and then, you know, puts her hand underneath the blanket and starts massaging the guy's genitals, you know. And it's a tough scene to watch because this guy's near death. I mean, he's dying of cancer and she's stroking him and saying, is this what you imagined it would feel like? Is this what you, and I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? And then suddenly it really kind of occurred to me. It was a good scene to sort of reveal a lot about Claire's character, how she's, you know, so much the other end of the serpent that Frank is. But ultimately, what I think what really was the heart of that was the show is a giant prick tease in and of itself. For me, the show, and I think you guys know what I mean. It's basically, the show teases us. It's cruel. It's a cruel show. She's being cruel. She's being deliberately cruel. You could argue it some other way if you like, that she's giving him his wish or something. No, I don't see it that way at all. She's actually teasing him and being cruel at the same time. And I think that's kind of what basically a commentary about the show itself. The show could focus more on the Peter Russo-Christina plot and storyline because it's beautiful. But instead, it teases us with these genuine and real characters, only to wind up destroying them. The one beautiful subplot that they have is destroyed in favor of a grand scheme of revenge. And I think basically the show is trying to measure the pulse or it takes a barometer reading of the current climate in DC, which is so hostile, which is so turbulent and so, just ugly, for lack of a better word.
That's a really good way of saying it. I think that's really what I was trying to get to earlier when we were talking to Chuck about how so many of these characters really fit the profile of psychopaths. Really lack of empathy and very, very charming, very conniving to win. And not necessarily money, but just to win power, to win whatever's there. Other than the Russo, Peter Russo and Christina, those are the only two people who really show any shred of humanity.
Yeah.
The rest of them is brutal.
And they kill Peter.
They kill Peter.
Oh, God.
Chris, when your reference to psychopath is right there on the spot. Frank turns into a cartoon supervillain and kills Peter.
And that is, it's a very chilling, scene for sure, but it's also, I mean, there are parts, times where I feel like this show goes too far in the sense of believability, I guess, and that was up there. But yeah, the one of the two characters who seems sincere,
yeah, I agree, Eric, and I think that's a really good point, and that's one of my criticisms of the show is the fact that this one character could orchestrate all of this. It does. There are times where it really does seem unbelievable or borderline absurd. Where really, the checks and balances are really completely thrown out of the window here.
Yeah, and those moments are like, I forgive the show all those moments because
me
of
too.
The other stuff that it has.
Sure, absolutely.
Kind of moments. But even when he, and Nick, maybe I don't know if you agree with this or not, Nick, but when Frank kills Peter, basically it seems like he was taking advantage of a situation that would help him, but it also felt almost premeditated, like it was his plan all along. I mean, the message is obviously, you're no longer useful to me. You might be a liability to me. But the whole thing seems orchestrated by Frank to make Russo lose so that the vice president, it's all very.
Which begs the question, why exactly did he want the bill to succeed so much then? I mean, this seems to be some sort of sloppy writing here and there, the backstabbing of Claire, which kind of like sets up this laborious and rather unmotivated subplot with the photographer in New York City and shows how there's a rift between them. It all felt a little forced to me and sort of like as a side trip we didn't really need to take. I don't know how you felt about that.
Well, I don't entirely agree. In the sense that that whole side trip with the photographer just shows you, in some ways, the severity of Claire and Kevin Spacey's character's relationship, how kind of functional it is and utilitarian and how kind of distant they are. It also shows that Frank is, or can be, worried about her, can feel something, at least at some point. But yeah, it went on too long. For sure.
I'd have to really disagree with you about that myself, because it seems Claire doesn't strike me as the New York girl, sort of running off to New York and having a fling with the photographer. She seems so cold and calculating in every movement. This is a woman that needs to be told not to run over dead people's graves, basically. She's she's yeah, I mean, she's so cold and manipulative. And I agree with you in a sense that there's this it goes to show that there's severity in their relationship. I agree with you on that. But she knew all along what the goal was. You know what I mean? So it's just like backstab them over the because she had to go behind his back to get support from this guy that he no longer likes, so that she could get her shit out of Hawk in Africa or whatever. It was a very selfish motivation, a selfishly motivated thing to do when she knows the grand scheme is all revenge and stuff. I didn't buy it. It seemed unnecessary and laborious.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see what you're saying there. I think she's the most interesting character in the thing, though.
I think she's upstaging Frank. I agree with you. She's Robin Wright is no slouch. She's a hell of an actress. But yeah, I mean, but she's sort of like underwritten in her overwriting, or overwritten in her underwriting, or however you want to put it. I want to come back one last moment here and just say that, for me, the show, you know, it could give us, like we said to Chuck earlier, this finding of the mythologized city on a hill, which actually we really need as a society right now. But instead, it likes to sort of dangle this sort of rotten carrot in front of us all, or basically jerk us off like a cruel woman doing to a guy who's dying in his hospital bed. And that's kind of how I view House of Cards. I'm addicted to it. It's great television. It's also kind of a big cruel joke at the same time.
That's really well put, Nick.
Yeah, I agree. Well, isn't that what some people see Washington as.
Exactly. That's why the show works so well.
Oh, on that note, I think that's great. I think on that note, we can sign off here and say that's a wrap. I'm Eric Marshall.
Chris Gullin.
And Nick Schlegel. And
cut. That's a wrap.